Good morning, everybody. Thank you for coming to our panel on the pilgrimages on the Minidoka Tule Lake. So thank you for coming. And obviously, I'm going to be speaking about the Manzanar pilgrimage as well. First of all, you know, we'd like to thank Janam for including this panel on the pilgrimages. I think that any thorough discussion and examination of how we achieved redress and how we got to the point where our government apologized and signed the Civil Liberties Act of 1988 has to include some discussion about the pilgrimages and how the pilgrimages helped our community both heal and become empowered and organized enough to achieve such an amazing and great great victory. So today we're going to look at three, Minidoka, Tule Lake, and Manzanar. And we have Gloria Shigeno from the Minidoka pilgrimage. And we have Stan Shikuma from Tule Lake. Stan's a really amazing guy. And myself, Bruce Embry, I'll be speaking about the Manzanar pilgrimage. And the early pilgrimages, I was a kid, so, you know, I've got to pardon my memory, a perspective of a 12-year-old looking at the pilgrimage, but I'll try my best. So, again, we want to thank Janam, and we want to hopefully today give you a sense of what role they play, what the role the pilgrimages played, but also sort of what it takes to get a pilgrimage, what it takes to get it going, and also what the character of the pilgrimages are. But I recognize some people in this audience, Tom Leatherman, former superintendent of Manzanar National Historic Site, also Joyce Okazaki, who I know her and love her because she is our education director of the Manzanar Committee, also our treasurer, so I say she holds the power. She's the real power in the Manzanar Committee. But she also is our cover girl because she is on the cover of Born Free and Equal, the reissue copy of Ansel Adams' book, Photographs, and Joyce is on the cover of that incredible book. There's also Soji Kashiwagi, another famous cultural worker, playwright, and redress activist, also son of Hiroshi Kashiwagi, who's also a very famous poet. So how many of you have actually been to a pilgrimage? Oh, wow. That's great. How many of you actually helped organize a pilgrimage? Yeah, that's great. Good, because then we'll count on you to fill in any gaps that we leave out. You know, you guys can feel free to jump in the discussion. So today, Gloria will start us off, and then Stan, and then myself. So, Gloria?
First, allow me to tell you a little bit about myself. I suffer from acrophobia, claustrophobia, snakeophobia, and speaking in publicophobia. So, you know, I get very emotional, huh? And I get very emotional when I speak about the pilgrimage. So I have my tissues ready, okay? But I am very honored to be representing Minidoka to you today. Minidoka, an American concentration camp, was spread over 33,000 acres. On this 33,000 acres were over 600 buildings. During 1942 to 1945, Minidoka was the home of over 13,000 prisoners of Japanese ancestry who were from Alaska, Oregon, and Washington. On our pilgrimages, we walk with and remember some of the stories of the lives of a few of those 13,000 U.S. prisoners of World War II who lived in Minidoka. Today, the National Historical Site of Minidoka has undergone many changes to restore our sacred grounds. During the past 11 years, with the cooperation of the National Park Service and Friends of Minidoka, and the strong support of two past superintendents, Neil King and Wendy Jensen, I'll kind of go over some of the changes. The reestablishment of Block 22. They've moved an original mess hall and barracks back on the historic site. preserving a fire station and a root cellar, constructing a 1.6-mile walking trail with exhibits, reestablished the honor roll, and we'll have a photo of that later. Presently, they're working on the reconstruction of the guard tower at the entrance. I'd like to share a few stories that I've heard while I was on the pilgrimage, and maybe it'll help you understand why so many people join us. Upon entering a barrack, a friend had to quickly leave. She stated, "Once I entered the barrack, it felt like someone had punched me in the stomach. So many memories came rushing to the surface. It was hard to breathe. I had to get out." A very soft-spoken woman started to speak, and as she remembered, she began speaking with more force and anger as we were walking along the trail. Most likely a story which she had repressed for over 65 years. I'm certain it was very cathartic for her. I remember when we were told to bring our own eating utensils, but we were not told what type to bring. So my mother brought those, you know, those camping utensils, those metal ones. And I think she was kind of embarrassed because she gave me kind of a funny look. On the first day, I remember we had to go pick up our food, so we were lined up with our new dishes. Our mother was so disgusted and embarrassed when they just slopped the food into our plates. They showed us no respect. From that day on, our mother refused to go to the mess hall for her meals. We had to bring her food back to the barracks for her. After Dr. Ruby returned from a pilgrimage, she emailed, "Thank you. I have made a full circle by going back to Minidoka. Now I can die in peace." And Dr. Ruby passed away a few years later. Reverend Brooks Andrews has been a part of our pilgrimage for almost 10 years. His is a unique story. He is 100% Caucasian. Reverend Brooks is the son of Reverend Andy, a well-respected and loved member of the Japanese-American community before, during, and after World War II. His support of our Nikkei community back then was incredible. Reverend Andy was pastor of the Japanese Baptist Church in Seattle. He even moved his family to be close to Minidoka to help out his Japanese friends. One of Brooks's stories is that they had just rented a house when one of the townsfolk asked his dad, "Are you the one who supports the Japs?" Reverend Andy replied, "Yes." Well, that townsfolk purchased the house that the Andrews were renting, became their landlord, then he kicked them out. 68 years later, Reverend Andy's son, Reverend Brooks, has been part of our pilgrimage by offering the invocation during our closing ceremony. He has come full circle, too. He is now pastor of the Japanese Baptist Church in Seattle. Since 2005, we have been so fortunate to provide scholarships for the college students to join our pilgrimages. These scholarships have been financed by Seattle University, Seattle NVC, Minidoka Remembrance 2003, and the Minidoka Pilgrimage. Each recipient is required to complete a project about their experience. We believe this is a real way for the younger generation to preserve their experience and to share them with others. Some have even joined our pilgrimage committee. What a wonderful side benefit for us all. They have so many new ideas and great questions, so a great asset. The recipients have been from very diverse groups: Japanese Americans, Japanese nationalists, Chinese Americans, Japanese Chinese, Hapas, Caucasians, Afro-American, Filipino-American, Japanese Filipino, Japanese Latinas, and a Muslim. They represent the U.S. from New York to the West Coast. One was also from Louisiana. We've also had three who were studying in the United States but were born and were still living in Japan. We even had one from Saudi Arabia. This is such a great way for our young generation to learn and share what happened to the United States during 1942 to 1945. and to make sure Executive Order 9066 will not happen again. In 2012, with the financial support of Minidoc Remembrance 2003, anyone who had been incarcerated in any of the American concentration camps during World War II and who were 80 years and older were honored with a scholarship. We had heard Tule Lake had been doing this for a while. This had been a dream of ours. Last year, we had over 30 pilgrims ages 80 and over. This year, we are honored with 26. Our eldest pilgrim this year was Amy Hirazawa. She's 94 years old, and she rode the bus round trip with us, which is, you know, over 24 hours. And she's so full of energy. We were also blessed with 9 to 10 families with 3 generations of pilgrims. They wanted to hear, to share, to listen Oba-chan, Oji-chan's stories. Being able to walk and listen to these stories on these sacred grounds with their elders resulted in truly understanding what sacrifices their Oba-chan and Oji-chans had to make. 4 pilgrims this year came with us celebrating their 70th birthday and were born in Minidoka. 2 were born in Tule Lake. They wanted to celebrate their birth and birthplace. As a pilgrim claimed, this is now a badge of honor. Nothing to be ashamed of. One of our younger planning committee members and a past student scholarship recipient has created a fantastic survey to measure various aspects of our Minidoka pilgrimage. Shanda Ishizaka, she's here right now, also tabulates these results for us. Isn't it amazing how these young people can, you know, with technology, put these things in? You know, I have to keep telling them, I was born when we had rotary phones, party lines, and TVs were just coming into homes. You know, like, I have to have somebody help me with this. Thanks to Shanda, I'd like to share some of the findings of why the continuation of pilgrimages are so vital. The stories are so important. A safe place to meet old and new friends. Dancing the Tankobushi and Gosho Ondo. A way to honor our deceased. Involvement of youth in learning and discovery process was very moving. A fantastic example of passing on the history. Having family join me. This is a grandmother who answered the same survey, with my daughter, son-in-law, and grandchildren, and even my husband. My granddaughter expressed wanting to go again, sharing stories, meeting Nisei, Sansei, Yosei, Gosei, and learning more. Another topic that Shanda had us answer is, why do we join the pilgrimage? Legacy, talk story portions bring back more memories that you don't realize you had. It is my duty, a life lesson everyone should be so lucky to experience. What a way to see the human spirit endure. An opportunity for my family to learn about the incarceration. They learned and received more information than I could ever give. I think the Yonsei and younger generation need to physically see and hear the stories of the Issei and Nisei. Being there is 100 times better than reading about it. Thank you for your commitment to increasing awareness of the incarceration and giving people a chance to learn about it from others' personal experiences. Thank you for the opportunity to learn, heal, and draw strength from the pilgrimage. I can see that the forced internment to Minidoka will not be forgotten. The Minidoka phenomenon will continue to manifest as Genki elders and young articulate facilitators bring life to the land and structures of this site. This passion for the pilgrimages remains paramount in my life. To close, it must be mentioned that the devotion and commitment of the Minidoka Planning Committee is what makes the pilgrimages possible.
And as I age, I appreciate the support and willingness to keep the pilgrimage a reality. I think the only way they'll get rid of me is at a rest area. When I'm going shishi, they'll leave me behind. Okay, and I'd like to share some of the mementos we leave each year. We encourage our pilgrims to write a message, and we leave it at the site. So Shonda will help us with that. And, you know, I'm getting so old, I can't remember what the significance of many of these mementos are. Okay, this was our in 2004. And do you see that casa? We used to have a Japanese antique store, and we had one that was kind of holy. And we thought, wow, what a great idea. So we just hung the cranes from there, the tsurus. And these are frogs on top of a varak, so kind of like kaeru, we returned. This is a guard tower, and I think these are more cranes. This is a different year. And then the following year, I think we put darumas. Is that what's there? I can't see. Yeah. Darumas. And then kois. This is the honor roll that has been reconstructed, and it lists all the Minidoka people who went to service. And these are 70 years later. It's just it's the symbol. And then that's barbed wire. Keith Yamaguchi made that the frame for us. And this year we had our name tags and then put the name tags in box. This box that was covered with the newspaper of Minidoka, the irrigator. Yeah. And this is just some photos of, oh, and then we leave it with the national park each year. So we're trying to get smaller and smaller because we're having less and less room to have these there. And these are the Yonsei Gosei group this year. You know, our pilgrimages are very small comparing to Tuyu Lake, who has 400, and Manzanar, 1,700 this year, and then they've even had up to 2,500. Hui! And these were all the people who were in any of the camps, and then all the participants. Thank you.
Thank you, Gloria. Stan Shikuma from Tule Lake. You know, Manzanar Manzanar pilgrimage has been called the first pilgrimage, and Manzanar was the first camp, WRA camp, to be built. There aren't actually any blueprints for Manzanar. It was that early. But in 1969, the Manzanar pilgrimage, loosely organized Manzanar pilgrimage, also by radical students, led by Warren Furutani and Victor Shibata, really wasn't the first pilgrimage to Manzanar. In 1946, from Gardena Buddhist Church, there was a pilgrimage led by Reverend Maeda, and who was actually a disciple of Reverend Nagatomi, and also there was a Reverend Yakahiro, who they returned because they firmly believed that they needed to pay respects and honor those that were buried in Manzanar. I'm going to have to borrow Gloria's tissue in a minute. So even though those who went in 1969 weren't aware of the pilgrimages by these three men of the cloth, there were pilgrimages prior to 1969, and those are our real roots. Those are roots that I think we need to remember. But it began as a loosely organized group. Warren says they were looking for a place to march. They figured they could march to Boyle Heights or to Gardena or somewhere, but then they discovered there was a place called Manzanar, so they scoped it out, and they returned in 69, a loosely organized group of students. My mother attended. She was working with some of them in the Asian American Studies Department at UCLA and was being driven home by a young woman, and she said, why don't you come on the pilgrimage? So my mother attended along with several other Nisei who had been in camp, Carl Yoneda, in particular Jim Masoka, who is a very active member of NCRR, and Susie Katsuda, is in front here. She's been at a lot of pilgrimages and also an active member of NCR. But the first pilgrimage is significant because it actually made this small group of people realize how significant the site was, not just Manzanar, but the camps in general, and how significant, what significance it held for the community. And so they got there thinking they were just going to do this one little march, and they realized once they were there, this is something that we need to continue. So they returned to L.A. Remember, they were there in December of 1969, very cold, very windy. They returned to L.A. and immediately organized a Manzanar committee that was incorporated, I believe, the following year in 71 as a 501c3. And they tried to figure out what to do. They knew they were going to return to Manzanar, and they cleaned up the cemetery and painted the monument. But they realized that it needed to be commemorated in a more significant way. So they petitioned the state of California for state historic landmark status. And this is a very significant development. Remember, this is 1971. Mitchie Wagland hasn't written her book. Edison Uno is just beginning to raise issues at JCL about the redress movement. The Asian American Studies departments are getting organized in their student strikes. But something relative to camp and redress is just beginning to percolate with Edison and some others. But in 1971, they petition the state of California, and it takes a year, but they win. And in 73, there's a bronze plaque, and the sister plaque is at Tule Lake, which states that camp was a result, Manzanar in particular, but camp in general was a result of racism, economic greed, and war hysteria. And what's significant about this is the first time that a government body actually recognizes camp and recognizes the injustice, and it is a statement written by those who were incarcerated. And that's the first, and it's in bronze. So no matter what the locals tried to do to it, and they shot it with shotguns, and they hit it with axes, and they did a lot of different things to it, but it still is there. That bronze plaque is still on the entrance to Manzanar as you drive through the stone guard sentry houses there. As you enter Manzanar, the bronze plaque is there. And it's significant because it represents a victory. So the Manzanar committee petitions the state, writes the language. There's a compromise. JACL and Manzanar committee draft the language, fight with the State Landmarks Commission, and get it passed. It's a victory. And it's a victory that says, this was wrong. So that's one of the reasons why I think the Manzanar Committee can actually persevere. Because we won. And it's hard to persevere and bang your head against the wall if you continue losing. But early on, the committee wins a victory, and it empowers them. They have a sense of empowerment. And then the pilgrimage becomes an annual event. People come from all over, like Gloria was talking about in Minidoka, from many different camps. People come from all different camps. Luckily, Manzanar is very close to Los Angeles, not too far from the Bay Area, so you have easy access. It's not Tule, it's not Heart Mountain, it's relatively close, and it's also, the pilgrimage is also held on opening day, fishing day, so a lot of the pilgrimages are predominantly women and children because the Nisei guys were out there fishing, you know. So on opening day was a very important date. It was no longer in December when it's snowy and cold and windy. So the pilgrimage by the mid-1970s is an organized annual event, and it has two characters. One characteristic is the political program, and there's a theme, just like with Tule Lake. Every year there's a different theme that is an important issue facing the community, or an important issue honoring someone who passed or honoring someone who had done something significant. One year, they honored those volunteers that had built the camp. So the second component, second characteristic, is there's an interfaith service. And this is an acknowledgement to the Men of the Cloth who had been going from Gardena Buddhist Church in the Los Angeles area to pray. So every year, we have an interfaith service at the cemetery. And so the pilgrimage has two components, and then obviously we have the Tankobushi and Ondo at the end. So it has a very similar characteristic to the other pilgrimages as well. And right after the state landmark and right after the pilgrimage becomes an annual event, the committee shifts its attention to demanding national historic status, which gets granted in 1985, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong, superintendent, former superintendent. But in 1985, the national historic landmark status is achieved. And this is important for two reasons. Remember, still before 1988 and the passage of the Civil Liberties Act, but in the 70s, the committee begins to work with elected officials, Senator Cranston, in particular Congressman Matsui, and other elected Japanese-American elected officials to begin to get the necessary legislation passed to create a national landmark. And so there's a there's activity, legislative lobbying activity, prior to, this is in the 70s and 80s, prior to any demands for national redress. Now, obviously, the committee is connected with other redress organizations and trying to get redress, but the pilgrimage committee begins to take on work in the legislative arena relative to getting the Manzanar be established as a historic site, national historic site. And, you know, both Gloria and Stan spoke about talking story. I think this is a really important component because the pilgrimage in Manzanar, every year there was someone who had survived camp speaking about what they had experienced, generally talking about just simply saying, this is what happened to me. And remember, this is the 70s and 80s, so most of the survivors were still relatively young. We actually had someone return to Manzanar for the first time, and she was 96 years old this year. But this was important because it helped people understand what the Yonsei or Sansei and Yonsei understand what camp was like. So the intergenerational sharing that occurs at the other pilgrimages was also happening at Manzanar, and it was a very important part of that experience. And so in a sense, the talking story, the sharing of the history and the experiences, it preceded the congressional hearings, the CWIRC hearings, which happened in 1980 and 81. So in a sense, there was a group of people, former incarcerees, who were already beginning to talk story and heal and explain what had happened to a more friendly audience, to to the community. And it helped prepare a group of people. It helped set the conditions for the community to later on testify in front of Congress. So these experiences, the legislative lobbying, the demand for the national historic recognition, the healing and the intergenerational sharing, all of these components became key elements of the broader redress movement later on. So in the 80s and 90s, well, particularly the 80s, late 70s and 80s, lobbying for congressional recognition and the passage of the Civil Liberties Act, and the preceded in 1980-81 with the testimony at the hearings, these were components of what was happening with the Manzanar pilgrimage. So in that sense, I think it's good to think about the Manzanar pilgrimage as help to setting the conditions for the redress movement to really grow and develop. And in one sense, it helped actually become the foundation upon which the community could then build and go on and achieve much greater successes. I wanted to read something. I wanted to read something that Art Hansen wrote. And Art Hansen, who is very well known primarily for his early work with the oral history projects out of Cal State Fullerton, he gave a speech at the pilgrimage, and I wanted to read something because I think he captures much better than I could ever write or say what the Manzanar pilgrimage was about. And what he says is, the great gift of the Manzanar pilgrimage to the redress movement is it forced Japanese Americans to view their lives, past, present, and future, with different eyes, and it gave them the desire and the strength to move mountains. The Manzanar pilgrimage endowed Japanese Americans with a will towards righteousness and pointed them in the direction of ways to achieve it. The two roles of the Manzanar pilgrimage, remembering the harsh past and drawing upon this memory to confront present injustices, has continued up through today And that is the legacy of the Manzanar pilgrimage. And I want to talk now a little bit about legacy because we have a national park there. We're establishing a national park elsewhere, Minidoka, Tule Lake. We're institutionalizing and commemorating these sites with bricks and mortar, and we no longer paint the monument. That's the job of the National Park Service. So this is an important development, and it changed the quality of the pilgrimage. My uncle, MIS, never went to a pilgrimage until 2004, the opening, because there's an American flag flying over there, and it was a government body, and it officially recognized site. It opened the door to include many in the community who had not wanted to participate earlier, and that's a very important development. So now the pilgrimage has grown significantly, and we average between 1,200, 1,500, and at the opening, I believe there was 2,500 in 2004 at the opening. So we have these historic sites, interpretive centers, we have staff, we have our Hakujing friends taking care of the site for us. It's very, very good. And so why do we remain relevant? And I think the relevance here is important to remember and why we keep doing this. And we do it so that America will never forget. We also do it, though, for our own reasons. And I think there's two things that came up, two themes recently in the Manzanar pilgrimage that help highlight this. One is, some of you remember the power of words resolution at the JACL and the attempt to do away with euphemistic language that downplayed and obscured what really happened during World War II. That power of words resolution took a lot of effort to get past and a lot of discussion. It was a theme at the Manzanar pilgrimage. Mako Nakagawa from the Power of Words Committee up here at JCL spoke 1 year. The Manzanar Committee endorsed it and worked tirelessly to get it passed as well. Joyce Okazaki, who's a longtime JACL member, Manzanar Committee member as well, worked tirelessly on that. And that was a relevant issue to us, to the community, today. And we believe we helped play a role in getting that passed. The other is highlighting the dangers of the indefinite detention that was signed into law by President Obama when he reauthorized the National Defense Authorization Act a couple years ago. Soji Kashiwagi wrote a very eloquent letter to the president explaining why that was a mistake. And I think these are constitutional issues. The struggle for, as the judge said this morning in the plenary, we the people are entrusted with enforcing and making this piece of paper a real living document. And this is why I think it's important to continue the pilgrimages. It's our duty, actually, to continue to struggle to enforce and make real the promise of the United States Constitution. And I think that's why people come back, and that's why people come to learn and continue to show up at the Manzanar pilgrimage and at the other pilgrimages. So I just tried to give you a sense of some of the political characteristics of what happened. There's a lot of logistical efforts. There's a lot of other things that go into pulling off the pilgrimages. There were a whole lot of hands that went up when I asked who had been at a pilgrimage earlier. So I really hope that you guys will make comments and ask questions about that. We are always open to hearing criticism. Also, if you have an issue with you guys talk too long or whatever it might be, we would gladly want to hear if you've been to any of the pilgrimages. So has anybody been to the Manzanar pilgrimage recently in the audience? Yes? Okay. And Joyce, of course. Any feedback? Any observations about if you went to the last one, what you thought about it?
Honey present. It was just an amazing pilgrimage. I don't know if this is working. But I also wanted to mention that on the third floor, the National Park Service and the different pilgrimage desks like the Minidoka and the Tule Lake, there are displays there. And also the Ansel Adams exhibit is up there. You see my picture when I was very young.
I think having been to a number of the pilgrimages, I've been to all three of the pilgrimages, I think that the thing that's the most amazing about it, and I think the thing that makes the pilgrimage just so important, is that it's a way for us to remember. And as much as the National Park Service is entrusted with telling these stories at these sites, you know, we are a government agency, and I think it's important for there to be a separation of the pilgrimages from what's happening in the National Park Service. Not that we shouldn't be involved in the pilgrimages, but there are things that you're all able to do that we can't do because of the restraints of as being a government agency. And I think that the Park Service should be engaged in what's going on, but we shouldn't be driving what happens in the pilgrimages, because I think it's important for the community to express frustration and desires that are outside of what's allowed by the government. And I think that's what makes the pilgrimages so powerful.
Can you state your names too? That would be great.
Hello. My name is Stan Ameda. I'm from Sacramento, California. And I just wanted to inform the panel as well as others, our involvement in the Manzanar pilgrimage actually it started with 9/11 and the Florence ACL spoke up, you know, in terms of the anti-Muslim features that were happening and saying, hey, this can't happen to another group of people, that happened to us. One of the things that happened is one of our members attended a mosque meeting in which the Imam Aziz said, if you want to know what can happen to the Muslims, you know, after 9/11, you have to visit Manzanar. We have been going as Florence ACL and the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE, to the Manzanar pilgrimage. We take a bus, about 50 people plus. We ride the 8 hours that it takes to get from Sacramento to Bishop and then visit Manzanar. So it's a weekend affair. It has been, I've gone to everyone except one for the last 8 years. And it's always the same destination, but a very different trip. I still remember our first trip, which was initially organized, and it was a trip that eventually turned out to be a pilgrimage. A pilgrimage is a visit to a holy place. And in that sense, each one of these have turned out to be a very very meaningful visit to a holy place. And we have, all these years, have had a Muslim contingent go with us. And they explained, you know, what they, you know, some of their systems and everything else, which, you know, basically enlightens us. And I think we still continue as an adjunct to not only Manzanar in terms of what happened, but what is happening now. And that's what drives us, you know, and keeps us going. And so we'll be doing it again. It takes the Florence ACL committee about 3 or 4 months before the event. We start organizing, we start recruiting members to come on board and whoever else. And we outreach and we do a variety of things. And so it's been, I think, one of the most meaningful events that we have ever done. Thank you.
Thank you. I think really important point about the relevance of the pilgrimages is to confront the anti-Muslim and anti-Arab prejudices and racial profiling. And this year we had a very young, very eloquent young woman from CARE speak in part of the Bridging Communities program that NCR, JCL, and CARE take on. Any other questions about the pilgrimage? Yes.
Martin, and I'm on the Poston board. Poston would one day like to have a pilgrimage, but you know we're small and we would just be starting out. So, what about the money side of it?
Money's always tricky.
Yeah.
It was always funded by community groups and individuals, mostly by my mother and Taki Yamamoto, poured in a lot of their own money to get this thing going. It takes about $8,000 to $10,000, right, Joyce? About that a year. We charter a bus, and we charge to cover our expenses for the bus. But you'll notice in that program that I passed out, there's a lot of ads. The ads are from groups in the community that value the pilgrimage and value our work, and also want to reach a very concerned and very specific audience. The ads are very effective for people who take out ads, and it's been a very useful source of funding for us. Other than that, we send out fundraising letters and beg. And we are a 501c3 organization, not C4, that got all the press, you know, but the C3 organization. Yes?
Hi, Tom Curry-Hara, good information. In terms of Post, and in contrast to what you've experienced in Manzanar, you have a fairly close-knit community that's logistically close by, whereas I think in Poston, that is not the case. So,
right,
and
right.
Also, we're on Bureau of Indian Affairs property, right, along with a sovereign nation property. So there are some issues that have to be addressed that are different from Manzanar, even from Tule Lake. Do you have any advice to the Poston group as to how they might be able to bring together the resources and to organize a broader community of interest to restore the heritage that we've had at Poston?
Two things. One is the Manzanar, in 1992, Congress authorized a commission, the Manzanar Advisory Commission, to create the camp and recreate the camp and to help guide the National Park Service in implementing that. It included representatives of the Native American tribes in the area, in Lone Pine. Manzanar's on Native land. And most, I think six camps are on Native reservations. So I would encourage you to include them. The other thing I would encourage you to do is look at the Heart Mountain. Look at Heart Mountain, because they had a similar situation. They're very far away.
Thank all the panelists for your in-depth discussions. It's very much appreciated. You know, to sort of examine each of the camps and get a sense of distance-wise how far the camps are from the Japanese-American internee community. And probably Manzanar is the closest one, I would guess. And so it's an easy ride, and you can rent a bus and all that stuff. But I think for the farther camps, and we're at Heart Mountain in Cody, Wyoming, how do you maintain the connection with the Nisei and Japanese-American internee community, and then also make it sort of financially viable with an infrastructure at that site? So I don't think you can look at one camp and sort of use that as an example. You have to sort of look at the lessons learned in terms of how that camp got set up from a pilgrimage standpoint, and then figure out what you need to do to tweak the system to improve it. I think that, interestingly enough, Heart Mountain really started aggressively with local Caucasian leadership, who then actively recruited Japanese Americans, primarily in Salt Lake City, LA, and San Jose. You know, Judge Raymond Uno and Jeanette Misaka from Salt Lake, my mom, my dad, and then San Jose, you know, linking in across. But it was very difficult, I think, to maintain that. So what we're trying to do now, we have a very strong Cody, Wyoming contingency, and interesting, we have our pilgrimage coming up, and of course everyone's invited to attend on July 19th. We're going to have Secretary Mineta there, as well as Judge Lance Ito. We're going to be dedicating the Victory Garden to his father, who was a superintendent during the incarceration. But I think 50 to 60% of our attendees are going to be Caucasian local people. So we're really aggressively trying to get, you know, Japanese Americans connected to Heart Mountain or not to please come out and attend. And it's so, in answer to your question, it's tough, but yeah, I think the survival of these institutions is going to be based on sort of an integrated strategy that makes our experiences applicable to the larger community. So we have to start recruiting people across the board to have an interest in this issue, and take ownership of it and not make it just our issue. It's the United States of America's issue. It's this nation's issue. And we all need to accept responsibility for the survival of all these camps. So I don't think there's an easy answer, but I think you need to do an analysis of what you guys do special apart from the other camps and play on it. Our special niche is the Wyoming people love us. So, and we're lucky. We've got Senator Simpson on our advisory group. So.
Thank you. Lancito's mother was my kindergarten teacher. Just.
I want to talk about the Tule Lake Pilgrimage.
Your name, Hiroshi?
Pardon?
Your name?
Oh, Hiroshi Shimizu. I'm with the Tule Lake Committee. And our pilgrimage budget is about $90,000. But we pay for all the housing, the buses, and all the meals. So basically, when you get on the bus for the pilgrimage until you get off, everything is covered. And the price that we set on that is about $400 for 4 days, three nights, all your meals, and all the and all the programs that that we put on. And with that, we pretty much break even or even make a little bit. The last pilgrimage, we offered free registrations to all former Tuleans that were 80 and over, and we had about 55 that that came on board. And so, you know, we paid for like 55 people, and you know, and still broke even. So, and one of the keys to us putting on the pilgrimage is that we have this college that we run the program through. And so, it, you know, the rooms are cheaper. The food's not that cheap, but we can feed everybody.
Thanks. Any other questions? Anybody here from another camp committee? Poston, Heart Mountain?
Can I say something? Oh, I just want to say one more thing. At Tule Lake, we have a current issue that everyone can help us with. There is the FAA is currently considering sticking a fence within the confines of the old campsite. The there is a public airport runway. It's actually used for crop dusters mainly, that runs along the old fire break that runs through the center of the camp, and the FAA is currently considering putting an 8-foot-high fence that encircles the runway. It would pretty much cut off the majority of the old campsite and would be a terrible eyesore. So if you go to the Tule Lake Facebook page, or we've started a petition on change.org to stop the fence. So there's also a Facebook page called Stop the Fence. It would help if people would sign the petition or write to the FAA.
Roy Iketa, I'm with the Tule Lake Committee. I understand at Heart Mountain, you really have a lot of support from the local community. At Tule Lake, it's sort of not kind of uneven. Stan gave the example of the fence that would encircle the fence, and if you stand any point, the fence is surely to obstruct your sense of how large this camp was and the feeling that this space would invoke. And as Stan said, we have on our website the name and address of the official with the FAA who is coordinating the investigation in compliance with federal law as far as the fence is concerned. And I would urge all of you to check out our website and send a letter, email, or a hard copy to Mr. Pomeroy at the FAA stating your feelings and objecting to this fence. But the other point I wanted to make was that our relationship with the local population is kind of uneven, and we do have a lot of support from a few people, but when was this? Maybe 6 years ago or so, when all of the buses were parked on a Saturday night in Klamath Falls as we were attending a cultural event at the Ross Ragland Theater, someone went by and shot a window of the bus out. And this is 6 years ago. And I understand that earlier that day, some woman called the Ross Ryland Theater and complained that a public facility was used to allow, Japs, our enemy, to use. And so it's just a struggle. And I would be interested to hear from other people at other camps as what their relationship is with the local population and how you try to develop better relationships.
There's a question in the back. We have like 1 minute, so I think that'll be our last question. But I do think this local population question is a really important one. Maybe we could talk after the panel about it.
With regard to the petition, do you have a specific number of signatures that you're looking for, and what is your deadline?
I'm not sure. Well, the deadline would be whenever the FAA is going to make their decision, which I think is a slow process.
Preservation Office has received a letter from the FAA, and basically it's asking the state to what extent is this proposed fence in compliance with the applicable federal law, which in a general sense maintains that improvements cannot be made if it negatively affects the integrity of the site. We're still waiting for the state to respond in writing. And when they respond, the FAA will call a meeting of interested parties. And following that, the FAA will make its decision. So the timing is uncertain. We don't know when the state will issue its position. I think technically it had 30 days, and that's long been gone by. So we don't.
Yeah.
When we find out when that is, it will be on our website.
Great.
Most definitely.
For those who are interested in exploring the issue that you brought up in terms of bridging relationships locally and with the state, Heart Mountain is going to be following on in our pilgrimage session after this one, so we could discuss that topic if you are interested in attending the next session on Heart Mountain.
That's great.
Because I do think that's a pretty tricky question.
Yeah, very important question. Gloria wanted to make one other comment.
I just wanted to share with you that to help us pay for the senior scholarships, every year we have a day of remembrance that Seattle U, lets us use their facilities. And then in conjunction with the day of remembrance, we have a taiko concert with 7 taiko groups that play. 10? Yes. Oh, 10, my God. 10. And it's, they each play maybe 2 songs separately, and then we have a grand finale, and talk about rocking. But, people from all over come, and so they learn about what the Day of Remembrance is, and they help support us so that we can give scholarships. People love taiko, huh? So, and it's, I think it's unique because I don't know if any other place has where that many groups join together, and it's not a competition.
That's great. But it definitely takes community support inside our community and those outside, because as was mentioned earlier, it's a issue that transcends our community. It was our issue imposed on us, but it was still our issue. But now we have a special responsibility and a duty to make sure that America understands it's America's issue, too. So thank you all for coming.